I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. President Trump has made unfounded allegations that mail-in voting is not to be trusted when the evidence shows that fraud is extremely rare. He's refused to say he would accept the results of the November election if he loses. He has called for an army of poll watchers to monitor voting, raising concerns about intimidation. His campaign has filed multiple lawsuits challenging state voting laws, including in Pennsylvania, involving so-called naked ballots, drop boxes, signatures, and poll watching. And yesterday, his pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett, would not answer when asked whether the Constitution gives the president the authority to delay an election. Well, with the election less than 3 weeks away, what you need to know about voting rights and voter suppression. And we asked Ari Berman to join us. He's a reporter for Mother Jones, covers voting for Mother Jones, wrote a book a while ago called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Joining us by Skype, Ari Berman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
You know, I've been doing this show long enough. I remember doing shows about the Diebold voting machines, about voter ID laws. Now we're talking about false allegations of voter fraud because of mail-in voting. We've got lawsuits, as I mentioned in my introduction. We've got a president who refuses to say whether he will agree to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses. Is the right to vote under greater assault in 2020 than in past elections?
Yeah, I do think the right to vote is under greater assault than in past elections. And it's for two reasons. Number one, because of the pandemic, because so many people have questions about how to vote this year that they may not have had in years past. We are going to see much higher levels of mail voting in states like Pennsylvania than we otherwise would have had there not been a pandemic. We are seeing lots of questions about how to vote in person, the traditional way. Will it be safe to vote in person? How long will the lines be? Will you be challenged at the polls? So there's all of these new questions that are largely related to the pandemic. Then you have Donald Trump, the president of the United States, spreading disinformation about voting nearly every single day on Twitter, which no other president has ever done. You have the president filing lawsuits in 17 states, including nearly every major swing state, to make voting more difficult or to refuse to ease restrictions on voting during a pandemic. And you really have the Republican Party committing through basically every facet of their power, whether it's making voting by mail more difficult or voting in person more difficult, to voter suppression is one of their main strategies to try to win. So yes, I do think the right to vote is more compromised this year than ever before. People have more questions about how to vote this year than ever before.
And you're going in and out. I'm hoping we can fix that. Ari, let's talk a bit about Pennsylvania. There's some other states I do want to cover. But the state court, state Supreme Court, actually ruled recently in favor of the Trump administration, saying the state can throw out ballots that do not include a secrecy envelope. This is the so-called naked ballot situation, whereas if you vote by mail, you're going to get two ballots. You put your ballot inside a second envelope, and that is the way that your vote is going to be counted. The court said that the state can throw out ballots if it does not include that second envelope. What do you make of that?
Yeah, this was the so-called controversy over naked ballots. And basically, it just goes to show you there are a lot of rules over mail voting, and voters need to follow those rules if they vote by mail. So you need to make sure you request your ballot early enough and send it back early enough so that it's counted. You need to make sure you sign it and sign it carefully so it can't be thrown out for a mismatched signature. And you have to make sure that you put it in the right envelope, that you put it in an envelope, the first envelope, the secrecy envelope, then you put that envelope in the ballot. And so if voters follow all of those rules, they shouldn't have any problems voting by mail. But if they're confused about voting by mail or concerned about voting by mail, they should know they can still vote in person, whether that's voting by absentee in person, which Philadelphia and Pennsylvania writ large now allows, or voting in person the traditional way at the polls.
Is it asking too much? And I know some voting commissioners are concerned with this so-called naked ballot that there are going to be a lot of votes that are going to get tossed. Is it asking too much to put one envelope inside another?
I think it's an unnecessary and ridiculous restriction on voting. I think one envelope is enough for mail voting. But when I voted in New York, absentee, which I just did recently, I had the same thing. I had my ballot. I had to put it in another ballot and then another envelope. And then I put that in a different envelope. It wasn't that confusing. So I think there's been a lot of voter education that's gone on about this. I saw there was all of these celebrities actually naked telling people.
I missed that one. Okay.
Yeah. Sarah Silverman and Mark Ruffalo and all these people talking about how to do your naked ballot. So there's been a lot of education about this. And I think, number one, people that vote by mail, I think, will get the message, hopefully, or people will just choose not to vote by mail and they'll vote in person because they're more confident their vote will be counted in person. So I am hopeful we are not going to see hundreds of thousands of people disenfranchised, but these are the kind of restrictions on voting that should be eased in general, but particularly in a pandemic.
Well, let me ask you about a ruling actually this past Saturday. This is a federal judge, again, in Pennsylvania, dismissing a Trump campaign lawsuit. The lawsuit wanted to get rid of drop boxes for mail-in ballots, had some questions about how to verify signatures and also allowing non-resident poll watchers. The court ruled against the Trump administration, calling the lawsuit speculative, didn't show that there was actual voter fraud at stake. What do you make of what that federal judge was saying?
It was a really significant decision because it was a Trump-appointed judge that ruled against the Trump campaign, that said that drop boxes are constitutional, that said that you can't throw out ballots simply for having a mismatched signature, that said that if you want to be a poll watcher, you have to work in the county you're from. And so these are all rules that I think are sensible rules that any court should uphold. But the fact that you had a Trump appointee uphold them and basically say the Trump administration, the Trump campaign presented no credible evidence of voter fraud, I think sets a really important precedent because it's not a liberal court. It's a Trump-appointed judge saying this. And so I think it carries a little bit more weight when it comes from the more conservative side of the aisle, being skeptical of the administration and the campaign's claims.
So, Alec, just to, and we've done, I can't tell you how many shows about this, but allegations of voter fraud, especially mail-in ballots or even, you know, people voting in person, that allegations of voter fraud are themselves fraudulent. True, Ari Berman?
True. A voter fraud is a very small problem in American elections. It happens from time to time. It rarely influences the course of an election, and it rarely occurs in large enough numbers to swing an election, and it rarely occurs, period. There was a study by the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative group and ally of the president, and they have only found 143 criminal cases of mail ballot fraud over the past 20 years, which equals out to 0.0006% of total votes cast. So when it's come time for the Trump campaign to present evidence of voter fraud in court, where it really matters under oath, they have been unable to do so. And even as we just mentioned, Trump appointed judges have been very skeptical of the slim evidence they've presented. So there really has been no evidence to justify their claims.
Are you worried? And I hear this from voters in Pennsylvania and other states as well, which is it might not be fraud, but there just might be mistakes or, you know, we're learning that how we vote is very decentralized. You've got people, you know, moving ballots from one box to another. Should we just be worried in any way that our vote will not count this year?
Well, that's a different question. I think the president is trying to confuse all of these things. He's trying to confuse mistakes that are going to occur with evidence of malicious fraud. And they're two different things. So yes, I am concerned votes not be counted, might not be counted. I'm concerned about possible mistakes. In Ohio, for example, in Franklin County, where Columbus is, they sent 50,000 absentee ballots to the wrong people. That wasn't evidence of fraud. That was a mistake they made that they then corrected, but the president seized on it and said, oh, it's a rigged election. It wasn't a rigged election. It was a mistake that was made that was been corrected. Election officials are under a tremendous amount of stress right now. It's very, very difficult to hold a presidential election in a pandemic. And so basically, there are going to be some errors. And the question is, can we mitigate those errors? Can we make them isolated errors as opposed to errors that occur across the board that lead to major instances of disenfranchisement?
Now, Pennsylvania actually doesn't start counting votes until Election Day, which means it's going to be a lot of work to be done to figure out who wins this very important state. Ballots that are marked on November 3rd will be counted as ballots, so that will obviously take a couple of days to figure out what the results will be. I don't know how unique that is to states that voting starts on Election Day.
It really varies across the country. Some states allow you to count ballots earlier. Like in North Carolina, they are starting to count ballots now. That is going to speed the process up. I wish Pennsylvania had done that. I wish the legislature had changed the law to allow election officials to count ballots earlier. That would take a lot of stress off the state and also let some national focus off the state. Sure. As well. But it's going to take a little bit of time. And I think we have to reset our expectations here. Election night may be more like halftime. And the question is, can we count the ballots in a week compared to a month? During the primaries, it took a very, very long time for Pennsylvania to count its ballots, and in particular in Philadelphia. And I'm hoping that even if it takes a little bit longer, it won't take too long. But I think the message has to be, in general, it's more important to get this right than to do it quickly. And it's more important to count the votes accurately than to get a quick count. And I think media, other people are doing a lot of voter education around this, but we just can't emphasize this point enough, that if we don't know who the winner of the election is on election night or the day after, that's not evidence of a conspiracy. That's not evidence of massive fraud. That's just evidence that we're in a pandemic and it's going to take a little bit longer to do things this year.
All right, let me ask you about California and this whole Dropbox controversy. The GOP apparently put deceptive Dropboxes in several counties. They were labeled official drop-off box or ballot drop box. What do you make of what has happened in California?
It's a very confusing situation, Marty. It's another attempt to spread disinformation and to confuse people about voting. And I'm not really sure what the California Republican Party was trying to achieve. Yeah. Were they trying to get Democrats to put their ballots into fake drop boxes and have those votes be canceled? The problem is those drop boxes were advertised on their website. So what if Republican voters put their drop box, put their mail in those drop boxes and then had their votes canceled out? So it seemed like it was almost an act of self-sabotage by the California GOP, basically telling their voters, put your ballots into drop boxes that will, where the votes will never count. So it just seemed like an act that was meant to confuse people. It was clearly illegal, and election officials shut it down pretty quickly. And I think that's the good news here, is that when disinformation occurs, people are on the lookout for it this year, much more in years past, and they're willing to shut these efforts down. And so it was not successful, but it just goes to show you the lengths that some people are going to take to try to confuse people and potentially to try to suppress votes.
All right. I want to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I want to talk about Texas. I want to talk about Amy Coney Barrett. Ari Berman, our guest in this first half of Radio Times today, and the second half of the show, we'll be looking at some interesting Senate races that are surprisingly competitive. Ari Berman is a reporter for Mother Jones covering voting and wrote a book called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm talking with Ari Berman. He's a reporter for Mother Jones who covers voting. We are talking about voting rights and voter suppression. Ari, let me ask you about what is happening in Harris County, Texas.
A few things are happening in Harris County, Texas. But the most notable thing is that earlier in the summer, the governor of Texas allowed counties to set up drop boxes for mail voting. They're basically locations for mail voting because you can't just drop your ballot off in Texas. You have to actually go to a location to drop it off. And there were going to be multiple locations in some counties. Harris County, Texas was going to have 12 locations. Then in early October, the governor said each county could only have one drop-off location for mail voting, meaning that Harris County, Texas, which has 2.4 million registered voters, is larger than the size of Rhode Island, has more people than 26 states, will only have one place to drop your mail ballot off, which is very concerning at a time when people are worried about delays with the post office.
But interestingly, I was reading that there are huge lines. There were huge lines, I should say, of people who wanted to cast their ballot. There are 122 early voting locations. There are 10 drive-in sites. So it seems as much as these boxes are not going to be particularly available, there are other ways of voting, and people are doing it.
That's absolutely right. Texas has made it very difficult to vote by mail, but they've made it actually quite easy to vote in person. And we saw a record turnout in Harris County, Texas yesterday. 128,000 people voted early in Harris County, Texas yesterday, which was a record, a huge increase over the first day of early voting in 2016, when 68,000 people voted early. And I saw a crazy statistic that said that more people voted early yesterday in Harris County, Texas, then voted the entire first day of early voting in Georgia, when there were also very long lines to vote. So despite the barriers that people are facing, people are voting in record numbers so far. Overall, 13 million Americans have already voted. I'm sure that will tick up by the time some people listen to this. And so we are seeing Americans who are very motivated to vote. And even if they see barriers in front of them, they are motivated to try to overcome those barriers and make sure their votes are counted.
Well, let's talk about Amy Coney Barrett. She is the president's pick to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. She's been asked a lot of questions about voting, including a lot of questions today having to do with voting rights in Shelby and a whole bunch of voting rights legislation. What did you make of her refusal to answer a series of questions about whether the president would commit to a peaceful transfer of power, whether the president can delay an election? And there were some other voting issues that came up yesterday. What did you make of her, I guess, non-answers to those questions?
Amy Coney Barrett refused to answer some very basic questions. She refused to say whether the president has the power to unilaterally delay the election. He does not have that power. She could have easily said only Congress has the power to change the day of the election without compromising herself in future cases. She was asked by Amy Klobuchar whether voter intimidation is illegal. She said she didn't know when, in fact, it is illegal. That was another thing she could have answered. She was asked whether the president should commit to a peaceful transfer of power. She refused to answer that question. And this is very concerning to me, because these are things that any sort of judge should be able to answer. These are basic constitutional questions. And if we're debating whether the president can delay the election, or whether he should commit to a peaceful transfer of power, or whether a voter intimidation is illegal, all of that plays into the president's hands, because these are not debates. This is all settled law. And Judge Barrett should know that, and she should be able to say that.
Well, in fact, the president has said that he wants a Supreme Court justice he wants the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, to intervene if there is an election dispute, to, quote, look at the ballots. And based on her testimony, do we have any idea what she would do or where she would stand on that?
Not based on her testimony, but I imagine the president feels so strongly about her because he believes that she will rule his way. And he keeps saying we need 9 justices on the court, but they already have a 5-3 majority if there's any dispute over an election. So clearly he does not trust Chief Justice John Roberts in a dispute over mail ballots, even though Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the decision gutting the Voting Rights Act and has been a reliable ally when it comes to writing or joining decisions, making it harder to vote. So it's really telling that the president believes that one of the only ways he can win is to challenge people's ability to vote and then have the Supreme Court intervene on his side in any sort of post-election dispute. I think the justices are really weary of doing that. I don't think anyone wants a Bush v. Gore 2.0 scenario, but the fact that the president is talking about this before the election has even occurred, while people are in the middle of voting, is pretty disturbing. And again, another break from precedent. You didn't hear George W. Bush talking about hanging chads and butterfly ballots before the 2000 recount in Florida. He wasn't trying to undermine the election before it had even occurred or before the results had even been announced.
Well, Bush v. Gore, I don't think we want to go back there. Let me ask you about Florida. I remember interviewing you about Florida. Voters in Florida said felons have the right to vote. People who have served time, once they're released from prison, they have the right to vote. Then the legislature, the governor stepped in and said, no, they have to pay their fines first. My understanding of Bloomberg and some other people have been paying off some of those debts. So where does felons and voting stand in Florida?
Well, it's a very confusing situation in Florida because the legislature added this requirement that people have to pay off their fines, fees, and restitution if they have a past felony conviction to be able to vote. Florida has no centralized database where you can find out how much money you owe on your sentence. So people are very confused about whether they owe money, if they're eligible to vote. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which has five Trump judges on it, a Trump majority on it, upheld this restriction. And so a lot of people who thought they were going to get the right to vote back did not get the right to vote back. And the numbers I've seen, initially there was a projection that up to 1 million people with past felony convictions would be able to vote in Florida in this election or subsequent ones. It looks like only about 30,000 people with past felony convictions actually registered to vote this year and are eligible to vote in the 2020 election. So many, many, many fewer people were disenfranchised because of these restrictions passed by the Florida legislature and upheld by a Trump majority on the court. And that just goes to show you, when you put onerous restrictions on voting, when you make voting more difficult, a lot of times many fewer people participate. And I think this restriction on past felony convictions in Florida is probably the best example in the country right now of the impact of making it harder to vote and how it could prevent hundreds of thousands of people who otherwise would have been qualified to vote from actually being able to vote this year.
So how do we make it easier to vote?
Well, there's a lot of ways we can make it easier to vote. We could automatically restore voting rights to people with past felony convictions. We could make it so that ballots are sent out automatically. We could make it so that every state has election day registration, that every state has automatic registration, that election day is a holiday, that every school has a polling place, every church is a polling place, every sports arena is a polling place. There's lots of ways we can make it easier to vote. We're not lacking for good ideas in terms of how to make it easier to vote. We're lacking the political will to implement them. And unfortunately, we have a situation where one party by and large wants to make it easier to vote, and one party by and large wants to make it harder to vote. And that leaves very little room for common ground when it comes to our election system.
Final question, and I meant to ask this earlier in the interview, Ari, about poll watchers. I mean, when does a poll watcher become an intimidator?
That's a really good question. I know there's a lot of confusion about this in Pennsylvania. You have to actually register with election officials to be an official poll watcher. So vigilantes can't just show up at the polls and become official poll watchers. There's a process. There's training for that. I'm not so concerned about those people. What I am concerned about is people showing up at the polls trying to create mischief and trying to intimidate people. If that happens, voters should know that they have a right to vote, that they should stay in line. They should call election protection, 866-OUR-VOTE. They should let election officials know about this. We already saw in Pennsylvania when officials from the Trump campaign were not registered to be poll watchers and tried to show up and create mischief at City Hall in Philadelphia, they were thrown out of City Hall because they had no legal right to be there. So if people try to intimidate your right to vote and don't have a right to be there, they should be escorted out either by election officials or law enforcement, and people should not be interfered with their fundamental right to vote.
Well, Ari Berman, thank you so much, as always, for joining us on Radio Times, especially talking about such an important issue, voting rights, voter suppression, and we're just less than three weeks away from Election Day. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Marty.
And welcome. That's Ari Berman, again, reporter for Mother Jones, who has been covering voting for a number of years now. Well, as I mentioned, November 3rd is less than 3 weeks away. And while the main event is the contest between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden, control of the U.S. Senate is just as important. There are 35 seats that are up for election this year. 23 are currently held by Republicans and 12 held by Democrats. Now, the GOP holds a three-seat majority in the Senate with 45 Democrats and two independents who generally vote with the Democrats. Today, we want to take a look at who is vulnerable and where things stand in some of the key races. And joining us is Ella Nilsson. She's a reporter for Vox. She's been covering Congress and the 2020 election. Ella Nilsson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, over the summer, I think if we were having this interview or doing this interview a couple of months ago about, you know, can the Republicans hold on to their majority in the Senate, the answer would be, yeah, looks pretty good. Looks like they've got a lock in when it comes to November. Today, it looks like it's much more up for grabs. What has changed in the last couple of months?
Well, so much has changed. I mean, the biggest thing I think that we have to remember is the map looked very different before the COVID-19 pandemic hit and the resulting, you know, economic downturn. And certainly the economy has improved since, you know, the spring when everything was shut down in order to try to curb COVID-19. But you know, we have had kind of a slow economic recovery. There are still millions of people out of work. There are a lot of parents right now who are trying to deal with, you know, schooling their children at home and working and, you know, doing everything else they need to do. It's an incredibly stressful time for a lot of people. And I think that, you know, Republicans, you know, told me back in the spring, you know, the political environment has been turned completely upside down. The big re-election message, which was, you know, that Republicans were going to tout a strong economy, that message had been sort of wiped out in an instant. And we've been seeing a lot of other factors that point to a really difficult, tenuous year for Republicans.
And it seems that the party and many of the people running for re-election or even election in the U.S. Senate have tied their fate and their future to the president, to President Trump. Does he have coattails for the moment that we're in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been really interesting to watch Republicans this year, you know, at times going closer to the president, such as when, you know, there was an opportunity to nominate a new conservative Supreme Court justice, Amy Coney Barrett. And then, you know, certain moments where they have noticeably distanced themselves, such as when, you know, Trump last week kind of erratically shut down the prospect of more stimulus talks and then seemingly, you know, kind of opened the process back up again. But it's been very interesting because, you know, a few months ago at the beginning of the summer or spring, you know, there have always been Republican senators who are just in politically difficult states. So we're talking especially about, you know, Cory Gardner in Colorado, a state where Trump is not popular, or Susan Collins in Maine, who, you know, certainly has a long history and a long, you know, her own sort of independent brand in Maine. But again, Trump is not well liked in that state. So these Republican senators, These Republican senators, you know, have always sort of been maybe more in trouble, but now we're seeing, you know, so many more states that are on a toss-up list, like Montana and Iowa and Georgia, and now even South Carolina is rated a toss-up by Cook Political Report. So the field has expanded considerably for Democrats.
Well, let's talk about some of those states, and let's start with South Carolina. Of course, the incumbent is Senator Lindsey Graham, who heads the Judiciary Committee and leading the committee as it decides on the next U.S. Supreme Court justice, being challenged by Jamie Harrison. He raised $57 million, this is Jamie Harrison, between July and September. I think that's a record, Ella. For a Senate candidate to raise that amount of money. What makes Lindsey Graham so vulnerable?
Yeah, South Carolina is a fascinating state. And I think that there is a combination of factors. I think that, you know, Graham is kind of an interesting political character in the fact that, you know, pre 2016, you know, he even ran for president in 2016 and initially was very critical of Donald Trump, and had always, you know, had a very close partnership with the late Senator John McCain of Arizona, who, you know, also sort of had a more independent image. So Graham sort of used to be styled himself as a more middle of the road Republican. You know, he worked on things like immigration reform with Democrats. But then after, you know, I think he saw Trump kind of being the head of the Republican Party, and he basically made a calculation to align himself very closely with the president. And I think that, you know, certainly there are a lot of people in South Carolina who like Trump, who are part of Trump's base. So Graham is making a distinct political calculation here. But I do think that there is also sort of maybe a little wariness among South Carolina Republicans who have seen Graham essentially, you know, shapeshift politically numerous times and maybe don't necessarily trust everything that he's saying. And then the other factor that we have to keep in mind here is, you know, South Carolina is traditionally a Republican state. You know, I think Republicans outnumber Democrats. But, you know, in 2012 and 2008, when Barack Obama was running, you know, Obama got about 45% of the South Carolinian vote. So there is, a chunk in the state that are open to Democrats. Certainly, it is a heavily African-American state that could help with Kamala Harris being on the ticket. Harrison himself, you know, is a Black man and is able to speak to some of those experiences, especially in a year where there has been heightened political awareness around issues like police brutality. So it's definitely, you know, a changing state, and it's a really interesting race to watch.
It sure is. And it's interesting to see how these coalitions coalesce. I was reading this morning that in South Carolina, if Jamie Harrison wants to win the Senate race, he needs liberals. I'm not sure how many liberals there are in South Carolina, college-educated women, Blacks, and disaffected Republicans. So it's interesting to think about how to send out a message that's going to appeal to this rather diverse group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I think that it's worth pointing out is that, you know, in 2018, we saw Democrat Joe Cunningham win a really competitive congressional district. And that was one, you know, it had sort of been on Democrats' radar, but it was considered a race that, you know, would be nice for Democrats to win, but they certainly weren't expecting to win it outright. A Democrat won there. He's up for re-election in 2018. It's certainly going to be a competitive race. But, you know, even in 2018, it showed that there was Democratic strength and certainly, you know, maybe independents who were sick of Trump. And that is sort of an early signal that we got about a potential for South Carolina trending more blue.
It's all very fascinating. Ella, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. In fact, I want to talk a little bit more about Susan Collins because I think that's such an interesting race in Maine. And that is Ella Nilsen, our guest on Radio Times today. She's a reporter for Vox covering Congress and the 2020 election. We are looking at some Senate races and who is vulnerable and what the results may or may not mean. Do stay with us. We'll be right back after this very short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Will the Republican Party hold on to their majority in the U.S. Senate? We're talking with Vox's Ella Nilsen about some of the closest, most interesting, most pivotal Senate races to pay attention to this election season. Ella, let's talk a little bit more about Susan Collins. She pretty easily has won re-election in past years. She's being challenged this year by a woman named Sarah Gideon. She's Speaker of the Maine House. She has been described, she meaning Susan Collins, as one of the most bipartisan members of Congress. Is she an endangered species?
I think she is. I mean, I think that moderate Republicans in particular have kind of been a dying breed even well before the 2020 election. I actually spoke for a piece that I wrote about Senator Collins' election this year. I spoke to the chief of staff of her former fellow moderate Republican Senator Olympia Snowe, who is now retired from Congress. And, you know, Senator Snowe's former chief of staff basically said, you know, even back in maybe the mid-2000s, moderate Republican senators used to joke that, you know, the so-called mod squad was so small that they could have their weekly meetings in a phone booth. And that gives you some idea of, you know, this is sort of a longer term trend that has been happening well before Trump was even kind of a blip on anybody's radar. And I think that Trump certainly has hastened that, because we're seeing in so many states, even in states that are more conservative, I would say, than Maine, you know, political polarization, I think, is really impacting how people are voting this year. And I do think...
go ahead. Sorry. No, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I do think, you know, there, even though Collins is sort of trying to lean in on, especially, you know, her moderate image, she's not saying whether or not she's going to vote for Trump. And she is trying to sort of focus on her senior position on appropriations and all the money she's brought back to the state. I think that a lot of people are looking at the bigger picture politically and really want to send a message to Republicans this year.
I mean, she seems caught between Trump supporters and Trump critics, but she did vote to acquit Donald Trump when it came to impeachment, and she confirmed Brett Kavanaugh, voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. Do you think that those two votes on her part hurt her?
Absolutely. I think that there are a lot of people who were certainly galvanized by her vote on Kavanaugh. I mean, there was a fund that was created well before Sarah Gideon was the Democratic nominee, a $3 million, $4 million fund just to give to whoever the Democratic nominee was to try to aid them in beating Collins. And so I think there are a lot of people that I spoke to, you know, who voted for Collins in the past, liked her moderate image, liked the fact that she was bipartisan, but saw her votes as trending to be more conservative under the Trump era, and just really were upset and didn't trust her anymore.
And as you wrote, she's the only Republican from New England, which I think tells us a lot. Let me shift gears. You had mentioned Colorado. Let's move on to Arizona. We've got Senator Martha McSally. Now, she was appointed to fill the seat of the late John McCain in 2018, and she's being challenged by Mark Kelly. He's an astronaut. He also happens to be the husband of Gabrielle Giffords. Where does that race stand?
That race is another really tight race, I think, that is trending in a way that has Republicans worried. It seems like Kelly has been leading in the polls for quite some time. I do think that his margin has narrowed a little bit. Some attacks by McSally seem to be, you know, having an effect, but the question is whether they'll have enough of an effect to sort of guarantee the race for her. I do think it's worth noting that McSally actually lost the 2018 Senate race to Democrat Kyrsten Sinema. That was an extremely close race, you know, showing that formerly Republican Arizona is becoming much more of a swing state. But she was appointed to fill John McCain's seat after he died. And, you know, I think that McSally has struggled for a while with her favorability ratings. People seem to not like her very much. And I think that that is worrisome for her.
Why don't they like her?
Well, I think that they're, again, Trump is a bit of an issue. McCain and Jeff Flake, another former Republican from Arizona who retired, I think both kind of had an image as Republicans who certainly might have been conservative, but also didn't necessarily stick with Trump with everything. They sort of had notable moments where they broke from the Republican Party and broke from Trump. McSally has shown herself to be a Trump loyalist. And I do think that there are a significant number of Arizona Republicans who, even though they're Republicans, might not be big fans of the president.
Well, let's go down to Alabama. You've got Democratic Senator Doug Jones. He's in trouble. Now, he had this surprise win in 2017 against Roy Moore. What's happening in Alabama?
Yeah, well, Alabama is just fundamentally a very Southern conservative, Trump-loving state. It's where Trump enjoys his highest net approval rating, out of the entire country, basically. And so it's just, it's just fundamentally really difficult political terrain for any Democrat. And I do think, you know, I covered this race a few weeks ago. You know, Jones's campaign will tell you that they think that the race, they certainly concede that they are the underdogs in the race, but they do think that the race is closer than public polling suggests. And they do think that even though Trump certainly is still well-liked in the state, that his approval rating isn't as solid as it was in 2016. And the other thing that both Democrats and Republican operatives told me when I was reporting on this race is is that Jones's Republican opponent, a former football coach named Tommy Tuberville, isn't really running much of a campaign at all. I think that his plan is to just be the Republican who is, you know, embracing Trump and hoping that that will power him to a win. But he really is not doing a lot of campaigning. He's running advertising. He has less money than Jones. So, you know, certainly Jones is the underdog in this race, but I think that his team is going to give it everything they've got.
And Tuberville beat Jeff Sessions in the GOP primary, correct?
He did, yes. And that certainly, that the GOP primary certainly was sort of a loyalty contest to Trump. And because Sessions, you know, was Trump's former attorney general, who the president had some not nice things to say about in regards to the Russia investigation, it sort of became, you know, Tuberville winning the loyalty contest to Trump.
Kansas. Now, you wrote that a Democrat has not won a Senate race in Kansas since 1932, and now it is an open seat. We've got State Senator Barbara Beaulieu, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly,
yes,
and Republican Representative Roger Marshall. What is at the heart of this race?
Kansas is such a fascinating state this year, and I think that what's going on is a combination of factors in the state and also national political factors that we're seeing everywhere. And the factors in the state, so, you know, Kansas is obviously a very Republican state, Midwestern, you know, seemingly pretty red, but everyone that I have spoken to has basically said there are essentially two different Republican parties in Kansas. There are moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans. And then obviously, you know, a lesser number of Democrats as well. And there are a lot of things that happened in the state. I mean, in 2012 and 2013, former Republican Governor Sam Brownback passed a pretty dramatic tax cut that really meant that the state's public schools took a hit in terms of, you know, less funding for schools, bigger class sizes. And I think that things that were going on in the state with the tax cuts and the fallout from that really galvanized a lot of people in Kansas who weren't political before, you know, certainly like parents of students whose schools were changing, to take action and to sort of speak out at the state level, and just kind of prompted a lot of kind of organic grassroots organizing in the state for state issues. Then you have 2016 happening, and a lot of people sort of characterized it to me as Trump almost sort of following Kansas's lead, you know, with the Republican GOP tax cuts passed in 2017 at the federal level. So I think that what you're seeing is, again, you know, moderate Republicans, especially college-educated moderate Republicans who might live in suburbs outside of Kansas City or Topeka, are starting to, you know, speak out and also maybe change their votes. And Beaulieu used to be a Republican state senator. She switched parties in 2018. So she's one of the people that she's essentially trying to bring over to the Democratic side. I think it's going to be very interesting. And the other thing that's worth noting is that Trump doesn't have as high of an approval rating in Kansas as states like Alabama or Kentucky or West Virginia. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of people in the state that are sort of turned off by his general mannerisms and sort of the chaos of his administration. And that is making Republicans, you know, kind of worried about a state that should be very easy for them to retain hold of.
Let me toss one more state on the table for discussion. This is North Carolina. You've got Tom Tillis. He was elected in 2014. His challenger is Cal Cunningham, who was recently found out to be having an affair. Tom Tillis also, correct me if I'm incorrect here, did he test positive for coronavirus?
He did. Yes.
He did test positive for coronavirus. So, boy, that's everything all sort of wrapped up into one. Where does that stand?
Yeah, North Carolina is another, very close swing state that, it's going to be tight both in the presidential and the Senate race. I think that, Cal Cunningham is a very middle of the road Democrat. He has been running on issues like expanding Medicaid in North Carolina because the state is one that still has not expanded Medicaid. He's running on, anti-corruption, passing an anti-corruption bill kind of similar to a House bill that was passed in 2019. And certainly, the last couple of weeks, the race has been jolted a little bit by these texts that leaked between Cunningham and a woman who is not his wife. And Tillis certainly has pounced on that as something, to try to influence the race. But interestingly, there has been some public polling released since the news of that affair broke. And actually, Cunningham's numbers appear to be going up, at least in the public polling.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, that'll be make it an even more interesting race to watch.
Yeah. And it was interesting. I actually was talking to a voter in North Carolina yesterday, and she's a Democrat, and she had already voted for Cunningham. And she basically said, look, sure, there might be these allegations of adultery, but listen, we have an adulterer in the White House, and I care way more about that than I do about anything with Cunningham.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, we're 3 weeks out, and of course, we're not going to know a lot of results on election night itself. But I wonder, Ella, is there any way to predict whether the Republicans can hold on to the Senate or whether the Democrats can actually make inroads and take the Senate for themselves?
I think right now, all of the indicators that we have, and that's, that's public polling, fundraising numbers, Democrats have really been, you mentioned Jamie Harrison's fundraising. Yeah. I think a lot of other Democratic candidates, maybe not to the degree that he is, but a lot of people have been raising, $20 million, $15 million, even in, places like Alaska. I think that the independent candidate who's running, who will essentially caucus with Democrats raised something like $9 million. It's wow. Really kind of eye-popping sums that we're seeing. So right now, everything points to it's going to be very close. It's going to be very tight in a lot of these states. But right now, I think a lot of folks think that Democrats have a slight advantage to take the Senate. But we are still a few weeks out. Things could change. It's a very fluid, political year.
Well, I forgot the most important state of all, which would be Kentucky. And, of course, Mitch McConnell is being challenged by Amy McGrath. He's been, I think, 36 years in the U.S. Senate. He is, of course, the majority leader. Is he in trouble?
I think that McConnell is not necessarily in as much trouble as a lot of, the members of his caucus. I think that, McGrath certainly has fundraised a ton, and more really eye-popping sums, which I think is kind of a direct reflection of how hated McConnell is just by Democrats around the country. But Kentucky is again, sort of like Alabama. It's a very difficult state because Trump's approval ratings are still fairly good there. And that's why we've seen McConnell embrace Trump and work with him so closely as Senate Majority Leader. He knows that people in his state still like Trump, and he's definitely, pandering to that base.
What's it like for you to cover the Senate races this year?
I mean, there's been so many to cover. I had started.
Yeah, one thing I saw, yes.
Yeah, I had started out thinking, we were going to have maybe five interesting ones to cover. And right now, I think we have about 15. So that shows you just kind of what an unusual year it is. And it's definitely an exciting year to be a political reporter and cover all of these.
And do you have plans for election? I'm calling it now election week because I just feel like, let's be honest here. It's going to take time to get results. Are you ready for election week?
I think so. I am, obviously we're all going to be watching the presidential results. But, the thing that I have really that we've really been striving to do in our Senate coverage is remind people that, if Democrats can't flip the Senate, even if Joe Biden wins the White House, they are still going to have a really difficult time at passing, any sort of progressive legislation that they want to get through. The Senate is a very important thing to watch this year. And yeah. So there are going to be a lot of states to watch, but I will be watching all of them.
Well, that's why we called you up, why we wanted to talk to you, Ella Nelson. Thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for Vox, covering Congress and the 2020 election, talking about some of the most interesting and pivotal Senate races to watch. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And wherever you get your podcasts, you can also get a podcast of Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.